The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This week marks the beginning, really, of a new year on many different levels. And we're starting a new series of study. You will either thank your friend or blame them by the end of the evening. And I wanted to try something a little different. And I want you to realize, by the way, that on a mystical level, this particular class, this particular week, the time of the reading of the first portion, Parshat Bereshit, carries with it a certain energy, the energy of beginnings. There's an idea that when I find myself at junctures in my life, crossroads, that you have to have a very healthy respect for the power of beginnings. For example, when a person gets married, there's a concept called Shana Rishona, the first year of marriage. If you're in yeshiva for a while, you call it Shana Rishina, you know? And essentially what you do in your first year of marriage creates an imprint, almost a paradigm. People who put themselves in tremendous stress the first year of marriage have a very hard time getting out of a stressful relationship. People who spend their first year of marriage studying, for example, there are many couples in Israel, certainly in the yeshiva world, who purposefully sort of try to do a lot of learning the first year of marriage because it creates sort of a framework for study within their lives, their relationships, their marriages. And that's true in general. You go to a job, the first day of your job, you make first impressions. First impressions are hard to overcome. And whatever you do on the first day usually sets a pattern that's very hard to undo. Actors discover this, right? The first role that you have, I forget his name, but he was Bruce Wayne on Batman when I was a kid. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, Adam West. Do you know that Adam West never grew out of Batman? He could never really get under to any other roles. Now that may be because he was just a Batman actor, or it may be because he got branded as Batman. And you see this once in a while in the entertainment world. And it's true for the year. The year has a cycle. And within those cycles, all sorts of energies. So when you begin something, in this week, which is the week of beginning, you're setting a pattern. So I wanted to do things a little differently. We're going to do an experiment. And I want to actually dedicate this class. I don't know his Hebrew name. I had the privilege of meeting his father once, quite a while back. Had a chance to read some of his Torah, a very special person. But I believe it was yesterday. Ari Weiss, the son of Rabbi Stuart Weiss, who made Aliyah from Dallas, Texas a number of years back, lives in Ranana, was killed by a Palestinian sniper. He was buried this afternoon. And it's one more juncture in what seems to be an endless series of purposeless experiences. There is something completely illogical about what's going on in Israel. Something completely illogical about what's going on in the world. No one has yet come up with a logical chain of thought that would make sense to any of us as to what happened last year on September 11th. What could possess a human being to do such a thing? Why a person and how a person could imagine that they gain. And I can give you all the theories if you're curious. At the end of the discussion, we might even get there. And so in that vein, we're going to take a piece of this week's portion of the week, this week's parsha, which speaks to this particular issue, to the completely illogical nature of conflict in general. And that's the story of Cain and Abel, Cain and Evel. First murder, first conflict. If you accept the context of the Bible, there are only four people in the world. That happens not to be Judaism's opinion. It's another discussion. When we get to the end of the evening, I'll be glad to share with you what that means. But for the purposes of our story, there are four people in the world. Two parents and two brothers. Sometimes, you know, when I look at my little kids, I understand how Cain and Abel got into their fights. But there's something absurd about the whole story. Now, what I want to do, instead of having a frontal lecture, I want to turn this lecture into a learning experience. You know, this book that we call Torah, right? We call ourselves the people of the book. Most of us barely ever open the book. And that's really sad. And I want to see if instead of this just sort of being an entertainment evening, that's assuming there's any entertainment, if this can rather be something that you participate. In other words, I'm tired and I want you to do a little work. So here's what we're going to do, okay? Anybody who's ever been to a retreat, you've experienced this on a rather grander scale. We call it the study buddy. And we're gonna do a little mini version of that just to see where we go with it. The goal, by the way, this year is every week to take a piece of the particular portion of that week. You should know that mystically speaking, the portion of the week is not random. This goes back way a long time ago to the period of Ezra, 2,500 years ago in the time of the prophets, who set up a system so that every week there are particular topics that somehow the entire Jewish people are learning together. In other words, this story is not just a story. This is one of the stories of the week. And if you go into any synagogue in the world this coming Saturday morning, every Jew everywhere will be studying this story. Because, of course, that's what the Torah reading is supposed to be. We're supposed to be studying. So we're going to give a little advanced preparation. And, by the way, just as an aside, I'm going to do another experiment, and I would so appreciate it if you will give me feedback in a few weeks as to whether you think this is right or wrong for you. Some of you know that we've been putting out a weekly Parsha Bite every week. And it gets longer and longer. I figure by, you know, next year we'll just put out a book at the beginning of the year and that'll be it. And I want to take this evening's discussion and make it the basis for the Parsha Bite. Because inevitably, as you will see, there will be questions that we will not get to. So in the Parsha this week, depending on what questions you ask, we'll take some of those questions and we'll delve a little deeper into them. And if you want to get that in email, you can just make sure that we have your email and you'll get it in email. And by the way, just as another aside, if anybody wants at any point the Parsha from last year of this particular week, any given week, you can send us an email and I'll be glad to send it to you. It's not a big deal. So here's what I want you to do. Maybe one more word of introduction because we're all from different places. There are two important pieces to Jewish study. One is the concept of a chavruta. Chavruta is Aramaic. It really means ha-chaver, the friend. Friendships. Jews traditionally studied in pairs. If you would have walked into southern Iraq, what was then Babel, Babylonia, 1,800 years ago, you could have walked into a place called Sura, or Narda, and you would have found yeshivot, pumpedita. In fact, one of them, the last of them, closed after almost 1,800 straight years in existence. It was closed down by the Iraqis in 1948. And during any of those 1,800 years, if you would have walked into this yeshiva, you would have seen them doing exactly what we're going to do. People pair off, and you don't have to be in pairs. Decide to sit in groups of three or four or five, but you can't do it on your own. The reason you can't do it on your own is because tovim ha-shnayim min ha-echad, two is always better than one. When two different minds attack any particular issue, they will always come up with different perspectives, which is a very healthy way of looking at things with somebody else's perspective. And what I want you to do, anybody, what is the most important piece of learning? Questions. Right? You have to find what bothers you. If nothing bothers you, you're not learning. You're just listening. So I want you to rip apart this text. The way to do this, and this is the only line that I'll repeat every week, the way to do this is first to read it on your own. Just read through the story. Then go back with whoever you decide to learn with and rip it apart. Find everything that bothers you. And in about 25 minutes or so, half an hour, we're going to get back together. I'm going to be here if anybody has questions walking around. We'll come back together at 20 minutes or so and we'll see what we come up with. And then I have an idea to share, but maybe you'll come up with it and you'll save me some time. Okay? So the text I want you to look at is the story of Cain and Abel. It really is the entire chapter 4. Go through the first 16, focus on the first 10. You can turn your chairs around, you can get into little groups, you can't learn on your own. Okay? First 16 verses of chapter 4, have a good time. And focus on the first 10. Alright, so let me hear what you got. What'd you get? What bothers you? And there are two things that I have to say. Number one, we're going to stick to what's called pshat. Okay? Pshat means the contextual understanding. And this is very, very important. Take, for example, the beginning of the book of Genesis, Bereshit. Imagine that I'm looking at a verse and I know all the words, but I don't know one of the words. And it says, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, and God says, let there be or. Now let's say somebody here does not know what the word or means. Does anybody here not know what the word or means? Somebody? Somebody really know no Hebrew, not know what the word or means, please? No? Okay. Alright. So if you didn't know what the word or meant, that verse would not help you. And God said, let there be or. Then it says, Vayhi or, and there was or. Right? Vayar Elokim Kito et or kitov, and God sees that the or is good. So now I know that the or is not, I don't know, pork and cheese sandwiches. But that's about it. It doesn't help me to know what or really is. Then it says, Vayavdel Elokim bein ha'or v'nechoshech, and God divides between the or and the darkness. Well, now I'm getting a little interested. Then it says, Vayikra Elokim la'or yom, and God calls the or day, v'lechoshech kara laila, and the darkness he called night. So or is to day, as darkness is to night. What is or? Light. So that means that the understanding of or as light is pshat. When Joseph's coat is ripped off of him by his brothers, vayafshitu oto, they ripped off his coat. Pshat is the understanding that's ripped out of the text. Now one of the mistakes that we make, and one of the mistakes that you will discover when you study in different places, is that people get confused. And you'll hear people say things which are very important and part of Jewish tradition, but they come from different areas of Jewish tradition. Medrash, for example, which is rabbinic legend. We won't go into it now. So I want to stick to pshat. Okay? I want to know what the issues are from the text. Alright? And the second thing I ask is that we sort of go in order. A little bit. Alright? So, V'ha Adam yada et chava ishto, and Adam knew Eve. V'atar v'atelet et kain, v'tomer ganiti ish t'ashem. And she gives birth to, she's pregnant, she gives birth to Cain, and she says, Kaniti ish tashem, I have acquired man of God. So, any questions? Yes? It's okay, yeah?
Why is it that she refers to, she acquired instead of we?
Right, do you notice, by the way, that Adam seems to be missing here? This is, by the way, a very healthy clue for all the guys out there. Just know your place. It's very important. Okay. Eve seems to be doing all the talking at the beginning. Anything else about this verse?
Well, it's not that she's only doing all the talking, it's that she's not even counting Eve, Adam, in the process that he also acquired Cain, the baby.
Well, now, wait a second. The verse literally means, right, Kaniti ish et Hashem, it's verse, by the way, verse 1. Here they translate it, I have acquired a man with Hashem. Okay? That's not how you have to translate it. You can say, I have acquired man to or with or at God. The word et is very impossible almost to translate. So, who is the ish? Who is the man? So, you're suggesting, and the translation here suggests, that we're talking about Cain. But there is another possibility. Who could the man be? Adam. Who is the ish? So, up until now, there is ish, and there is isha. There is man, and there is woman. So, ish is Adam. So she acquires Adam with God. Now this, by the way, we're not going to get there, but this is a very deep idea. She gives birth, and in birth, she acquires somehow a relationship with God through her husband. Something happens to their relationship that changes. And it's very deep. Somehow they bring God into the equation. There's a beautiful idea that tradition teaches us that, you know, the word for ish is Aleph, Yud, and Shin, three letters. The word Risha, Aleph, Shin, and Hey. They have two letters in common. It's not the same as man and woman. Right? There's a certain chauvinism implied in the word woman, that she's sort of the womb from man. But in the word Ish and Isha, they share two letters, Aleph and Shin, and they have each a distinct letter. The one a Yud and the one a Hey. Because there's a balance there. They complement each other. And the rabbis suggest that if the Yud and the Hey are in their names, Yud and Hey are spell the name of God, if God is in their relationship, then they have union. But if you take what's distinct about them out, the Yud and the Shin, all you're left with is Esh, Aleph and Shin, and that's fire. If God isn't found in the equation with two people who are in love, then all that's left is fire. And it may well be that we're about to discover that in the story of Cain and Abel. And by the way, we're speaking here also about the purpose of their union. You know, we live in a society, it's very interesting. And it's very difficult to communicate this. But you know, I guess one of the most common questions that you get, and I don't think it's only true for rabbis, but you know, a person meets somebody else. I met a guy, he's a nice guy, he has these qualities, he doesn't have those qualities, and I'm not sure, you know, whether he's right for me. So I say, what makes you think he's right? What are you looking for? And the answer always is, you ask them what they're looking for, I'm looking for someone who gives me the following. Think about that line. What many people are looking for is what someone else will give to them. That's not what Judaism has to say about relationships. Judaism says what's important is not what he gives me. What do I have to give him? I'm looking for someone to whom I can give the following. Now, if you want to know who's right for you, you have to know what you have to give them. And in order to know what you have to give them, you have to know who you are and what you have to give. Then you have to find someone who really needs what it is that you have to give. Because if you find someone else who doesn't need what you have to give, then you're not really there. That's a very powerful idea in developing relationships. By the way, it's not only true for men and women in love and marriage. It's true in everything. The most important challenge, you know, when children are growing up, at a certain point, what do they have to give their parents? I think this is part of the challenge of teenagehood. And I'm just beginning to be on the verge of discovering this with our eldest. So if I go to Alaska for a few years, you'll know why. But the teenager says, basically, my parent gives me everything. And you know, you aren't what you take. We very often think that we are what we do, we are what we have. Right? I was recently talking to somebody who's a trader. And he's very challenged because in the last period of time, his trading is not doing well and he's lost a lot of money, whatever. Gets to the point that the amount of money that he has expended on paying the firm that he leases, Zechvesnisht, don't claim to understand this, is more than the amount that he's earned. So it's basically, it would have been better for him if he had sat home and not leased any space in his office. And he was sort of struggling with what's really bothering him. And there's a certain humiliation in being a trader where you're not earning money. And I was just shocked by this. What does that mean? So, well, you know, we're all traders and we judge each other by how well we do. If you're successful, you earn a lot of money, you're good for the firm. But if you don't earn a lot of money, then what are you good for? That's unbelievable. I'm judged not by who I am, but by how much money I make. People buy big cars because I judge you by what kind of car you have. And there are certain parts of America where you can go where really, unbelievably, if you don't have a Porsche or a Lamborghini, you don't get into the club. Unbelievable. Judaism says, I am not what I have. I am what I give. Because what I give is all I really have in this world. So if I don't have what to give, then I'm not really. And that's why sometimes children of very successful people have such challenges. Because when someone is that successful, they give their children everything. And if I'm doing all the giving, and my child has nothing to give back, then he's not really there. So children rebel because they want to say, I'm here, I'm here. And that's essentially what Chava is saying here, is I have what to give. Up until this moment, what do Adam and Eve have to give? They've just been given two. God creates them, God gives to them, God puts them in the Garden of Eden. Now all of a sudden Chava realizes she has what to give. And she, by the way, one of the reasons that the woman essentially has on certain levels, a deeper relationship with God. In fact, according to tradition, you know, if you look at the order of creation, so the first thing that's created is a lower, sort of on the level, on the cycle of life. Inanimate objects are first created, later plant life, later fish and animals, finally human beings, and Eve, Chava, woman, Isha, is created last. She is the pinnacle of creation. That's why the Talmud says that we have no prophecy left in the world, but there's one taste of prophecy, and that was left to women. We call this, according to some, women's intuition. It's a very healthy thing. You get married, you start to learn. In fact, the only place in the Torah, we were just talking about this somewhere, I don't remember where, the only place in the Torah where God actually gets involved in marital relationships, he doesn't get involved in Rachel and Yaakov, and they have lots of trouble. But he gets involved with Avraham. And Avraham, you know, has a problem because Sarah wants to kick Ishmael out of the house, and Avram doesn't, well, he can't bear to do it, and God steps in, and God says, Kol asher tomar Sarah tishma b'kola. Whatever Sarah says, listen to her. And there's an underlying idea that the rabbis share, that if you have a healthy relationship with your wife, it's because you learn to listen to her. I've learned that whenever I listen to my wife, it ends up good. And whenever I don't listen to my wife, I end up in trouble. And by the way, that's a very deep question, which if you will remind me towards the end, in 20 or so minutes, if you will remind me, that has very much to do with this. Because sometimes I don't listen to my wife because I think she's wrong. Or I know she's wrong. How do you find the difference in that? But that's what's going on here. Chava is one step closer. She has the greater part in the gift of life because she carries the child and the womb within. So she is expressing the real purpose of what relationships are about. Too often people get together because it gives me something. That's not love, that's lust. Lust is all about taking. Love is what you have to give. Okay, don't worry, we're not going to get this deep on every verse. We'll never get anywhere. But all right. Next verse. Vatosef laledet et achiv et havel. Right? So she continues, and she gives birth to Hevel. It's very interesting, because Hevel, Abel, he doesn't get named the same way. He's just like, you know, and we have this great son, Cain, and also we got Abel. Sometimes Nebuchadnezzar, you meet families like that. So it's fascinating, because if you read these two verses, you would think that Abel was the one who's going to make trouble. So it's interesting that it becomes Cain. One thing I want to point out to you, the difference between a rabbinic comment which is based in pshat, in the context, and a rabbinic comment which is not based in the context, there's a tradition that Abel and Cain were twins. And it is based on this verse, Vatosef laledet. If you look at verse 1, it says, Vatahar vatelid, and she became, she conceived and bore Cain. Vatahar actually means she became pregnant. And then she had Cain. But in the second verse it says, she continued to give birth. Additionally, she bore the brother. There's no additional conception. So the opinion is that she had twins. Now, by the way, you got to imagine what this must have been like. Putting aside all sorts of mystical traditions about Eve being a prophetess and whatever else is going on, imagine this is the first time that a child is born. And they have no idea what's flying. There's no manual. There's no Columbia Book of Pregnancy back then. So all of a sudden, her belly explodes and she starts... So you'll tell me, but she doesn't have childbirth pain yet. It still must have been a freaky experience. And then she has a child. And all of a sudden another one pops out. So she's not ready for this. And I wonder what that has to do with the story. Okay. Now let's get to some tachlis. Talk to me about the story of Cain and Abel. What bothers you about the story of Cain and Abel? Anybody? Yes?
They were shepherded as...
Right. Did you notice that? Did you? By the way, parents do this all the time. This is, you know, this is Christopher. He's going to be the doctor in the family. Come on, smile, Christopher, right? You know, that's right. But okay, putting that aside. Okay, so I'm not going to go there right now. Whether there's some mystical, you know, they don't have to go through growing up pains. Adam and Eve were not real parents because there were no phone bills. They had no teen rows. All of a sudden, or one could suggest the Torah only tells me what's important, what I need to learn. So I guess if Cain and Abel had puberty, it wasn't important for me. And I think we're all best off not learning from puberty, but okay, right? So what's important here is that one of them is a shepherd. Abel is a shepherd. Cain, he's a farmer. Okay. Any questions you have about the story of Cain and Abel? Yes?
Did Cain take the harder career path?
Well, let me make that a little deeper, okay? You're Cain or Abel. And you got the whole world. Okay? What would you do? Why do you have to do anything? Why do they need professionals? I mean, if there are sheep in the world, there are a lot of sheep. I mean, you have to be a farmer? Eat grapefruits the rest of your life. You could travel the world eating papaya. So it's fascinating that they have a profession. This also, by the way, speaks to what's called the tikkun of creation, the path that we're meant to be created on. Because we need purpose in our lives. It's interesting. This, at least according to the context of the Bible, is before the mistakes that were made. But rabbinic exegesis is that it's after. So whichever way you go, right? I'm sorry, vice versa. The majority opinion is that this is after Adam and Eve leave the Garden of Eden. Right? And that fits with the context of the verses. So all of a sudden, they can't be in the Garden of Eden. You kind of wonder whether they have a huge chip on their shoulder towards their parents, because life could have been easy. So they have to take a job. And of course, that has to do with the fact that what's real in this world is what I earn. And back to what I was talking about before, that I need to be giving and producing in order to have purpose in my life. What else? First of all, take a look at this. Who gives the first sacrifice, the first korban? Who gives the first one?
Cain,
right? This is the first sacrifice in human history. Put aside for the moment what a sacrifice is. Cain comes up with this brilliant idea. He's going to give a sacrifice to God. That's awesome. We don't see in the text that Adam ever gives a sacrifice to God. Eve doesn't give a sacrifice to God. Abel hasn't even thought of giving a sacrifice to God. Cain comes up with this idea to give a sacrifice to God. So one would think that Cain is a tzaddik. He's unbelievable. So how come Cain gets into all the trouble, right? Number one. Number two, what is a sacrifice? What's the purpose of a korban? What am I doing with a sacrifice? It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Who is Cain giving a sacrifice to? Does God need a sacrifice? So what's going on? What's the purpose of a sacrifice? I mean, picture this scene. There's just God and a couple of kids. And one of the kids takes a bunch of vegetables and I guess throws it on top of some boulders, sets them on fire, and offers up, you know, you ever see when you're in camp and they take everything and put it in a cup and they, you know, whatever, and you get in trouble? You know what I'm talking about? And who's going to drink it? Never mind, maybe it was just me. Okay, I was a horrible kid, right? Who's going to, this is my sacrifice. So he offers up this sacrifice to God. So you got to figure God is sitting up there saying, I mean, what's he thinking? Why does God need this sacrifice? So you'll tell me, God doesn't need the sacrifice. Cain, what does that mean? Where does this idea come from? And ask me the question. Whose fault is this whole story? The parents.
Where were they?
Okay, that's a very good question. What were the parents doing? Didn't they see there was a problem? I'll go you one further. Because I don't think it was the parents' fault. Whose fault was it? God! Vayisha Hashem el hevel el minchato. And God favors Abel's sacrifice. And no, it's not enough that it tells me that he favors Abel's sacrifice. But v'al kain v'al minchato lo sha. And he doesn't favor Cain's sacrifice. So this is God? I mean, a few of us were talking about this over here. You've got two brothers, and they're each offering sacrifices. Okay? How many possibilities do I have? Let's count. Okay? Let's say two of my children, Mayan and Yonatan. It's my birthday. They get all excited. And they get all excited, they're each going to give me a birthday present. Right? So Mayan comes on in, and she gives me daisies that she picked from the garden. And Yonatan comes in, and he made me a mud pie. Now I've got a few possibilities. I can tell them both, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't want either of your sacrifices, go back to bed. I don't accept either. Or I can tell them both, these are both magnificent, make them both feel a mile high and accept them both. Or I can only talk to Mayan, or only talk to Yonatan, accepting one or the other. Or I can accept one and reject the other of either one of them. So I've got 6 possibilities, am I right? Let me ask you a question. Do you follow that? Which is the worst thing that God could do? What is the worst thing that God could do? Accept one and reject the other. And that's what God does. That's unbelievable. And by the way, who does he reject? The one who came up with the idea in the first place. So this is God's fault. All the stories we're going to read in the book of Genesis embrace it. About the favoritism of sons, all the problems Yaakov had, he learned from God. So what's going on here? And by the way, let's just have one more question, and then we'll see if we can put it together. What is the ultimate question? The ultimate question. Cain and Abel, and I wish we had time to go through this verse by verse. So Cain and Abel have an argument. What are they arguing about? Did anybody see the verse where it says what they're arguing about? Because it doesn't say. That's amazing. I mean, you would think that that was rather important to the flow of the story. First, but it doesn't say jealousy. I mean, they're telling the story of the first murder in history. First conflict in history. What's the root of the conflict? What's going on here? And by the way, note this point. Take a look at verse... I mean, there are 2 points here that I find tremendously challenging. Pasuk Chet, verse 8. Vayomer Kain al Hevel Achiv. And Cain says to the brother Abel, follow this inside. This is an unbelievable verse. And Cain said to Abel, his brother, Vayehi, and it was, Biotam Basadeh, when they were in the field. Vayakam Kain al Hevel Achiv Vayargeo. And Cain, rises up against his brother Abel and kills him. What's missing from this?
Why?
Yeah. What did he say? I mean, can you imagine the scene? It's the soap opera of the week. This is the first soap opera in history. There's nothing else to watch on TV. Everybody's watching the soap opera. And you have this incredible moment. And you know, you can imagine the music and the sky grows dark. And Cain arises in the field. And this is the big line. This is what they're going to show in the previews. And then, you get static and you miss the line. The next thing, he's dead. But what did he say? The Torah doesn't even tell me. What's going on? And it says, Vayomer Kain al Hevelachiv, and Cain said to his brother. It isn't like it doesn't even say that he said anything. It actually says, and he said to him, and it doesn't tell me what he said. So I want to tell you a very deep idea, so that I can then contradict it. Okay? I'm going to share with you two thoughts, and then what you do with it, we'll see, and hopefully, those of you who read the email this week, we'll get a little more into it. This is very deep. Two brothers. They have the entire world before them. And they can't get along. And there's a moment of conflict, and I don't even know what the conflict's about. And I wonder if that isn't the entire point. If the Torah is telling me that if a brother could rise up against a brother and kill him, it doesn't matter what he said. The Torah doesn't tell me why they're arguing, because they don't want, the Torah doesn't want me to make the mistake of thinking that there can be a why. I want you to know this is very important. You know, we're living in a time of such conflict. You sit in a pizzeria, and people walk into a pizzeria and blow themselves to bits. And you hear of children with nails lodged in their hearts, and parents grieving, horrible stories. It's so crucial to remember that conflict has at its root something completely illogical. And this is not only true for the perpetrator, but for the victim as well. It's a very dangerous thing, and a very fine balance, to run up a hill, to completely believe in the justification of what it is you're doing. There's a terrorist firing at you, and whoever fires first wins, and you take him or he takes you. And I'll tell you, by the way, the epitome of this for me. I remember, and anybody who's ever met me, eventually you realize, of course, you're my therapy group for things like this, because there was a time I couldn't talk about these things. But we were on patrol, and Lashab Lechima V'Shetach Banui, fighting in a built-up zone, is a very difficult type of warfare. And tanks aren't meant to be inside of alleyways. They're meant to be out in the field. And we're driving, we're doing a patrol, and they train you for this. I remember an officer's course, we spent a whole day on this. And I thought it was ridiculous. And the base commander himself, Mufaz, who was the last chief of staff of the Israeli army, spent 2 hours with us. Until he was absolutely certain that every cadet in the base, and everyone in our course, completely understood, agreed with, hook, line, and sinker, this idea. And it was one of those seminars that we had on ethical dilemmas, and a lot of the guys kept the discussion going because they knew then we didn't have to go out in the field and run around in the mud anymore. And it was only months and months later that I finally got it, because we're doing this patrol, and I see a tube that's moving a little, sticking out from behind a building, maybe the distance from here to the end of the lobby over there. 100 yards, I don't know. And they train you for this. You could recognize these things. If you're a tanker, somebody could throw you a photograph of an RPG in your sleep. In fact, they used to do a test in officer's course, and they used to wait to do it until on Friday morning. They would wait until we were in our dress uniforms getting out for the weekend. Sometimes they would even they would start the bus, and you had all your gear ready to go out for the weekend, your bag, your kit bag. And then they would say, Smulap, play! Kulap! Everybody goes into the room, and you have this like 10-minute quiz, a pop quiz. And it was a quiz on Todan, enemy weaponry. And you had to score a perfect score on the test. If you didn't score a perfect score on the test, you got stuck behind for Shabbat. Sadistic bums that they were. Because if you're out in the field, and you see a speck in the distance, and you don't know if it's a gazelle or a defender, or a cobra or a helicopter, you don't have time to wait until it gets close enough to see the markings. So they drilled into us. But there were two weapons that you could count on. They were on every test. One was a BMP-1, which is a personnel carrier that carried SAGR anti-tank missiles, because we were tankers. And the other was an RPG. You could throw a tanker in the middle of the night a picture of an RPG, and he can spew out to you what it is, how it's made, what its range is, how to... everything. So when you see one of these tubes, you don't have to think. You know exactly what it is. You're in Beirut. You see an RPG sticking out of a minor building. So you don't have time. Normally the gunner, you know, he's got a narrow field of vision. So he's sort of looking, and you normally have an override. It's called a mashbet. You have an override, and you can bring him to the target. But when you're in such close combat quarters, you've got a shell already in the cannon. You don't have time to bring him. So you override him, and you bring the gun to where it has to be, more or less. And you have a shell in the breach that's double purpose. It can work against armor, to pierce armor, and it can also work against infantry, anti-personnel, because you don't know what's going to come out. That's like the sort of the tech in what you do when you're in a built-up zone. And you have a trigger there, because you can't wait for the gunner to find it and to shoot. And as you're about to pull the trigger, and this fellow is jumping out from behind the building, and it takes about a second and a half, to aim and fire an RPG. Another Israeli here, and I'm sure he knows this as well as I do. It takes a second and a half. It's a second generation, you don't have to keep your sight on, you fire it and that's it, you can run away. And whoever fires first wins. And we were in Patton tanks, an RPG would peel away the front of a Patton tank. And by the way, it's not just your crew, it's the tanks behind you and the APCs behind you, because if you get caught in the front, stuck in an alley, it could be an ambush. So whoever shoots, like the Wild West, whoever shoots, and you don't have time to think, you don't have time to be brave, there's no issue. There's nothing to do with you. It's totally a question of whether your commander's trained you well. Nothing to do with you. So in all the commander's courses and the officer's courses, they started inculcating that, guys, you know, when you come up with this and realize it and agree with it and justify it and everything. So intellectually, I have no doubt, absolutely no doubt, that you're doing the right thing. But of course, watching a seven-year-old kid explode from a tank shell stays with you forever. There is something, even when you're right, something completely illogical. It is absolutely and completely illogical for two people to end up in conflict in this world. And by the way, this isn't just a story about if you're in Lebanon in a war. Hashem should bless everybody here, you're not going to go to Lebanon and be in a war. This is a story for when you get on the bus and somebody pushes by you and you get that Cain syndrome. Because who are you to push by me? And then you understand that both of you are created in the image of God, something completely illogical about conflict. It doesn't serve purpose in the world. It creates no good in the world. It isn't what you're here for. It's against everything you believe in intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, on every level. And yet it's there. That's the challenge of one of the first stories in the Torah. That's point number one. Point number two, and this is something to think about. What is really at the root of what's going on with Cain and Abel? It's very interesting. The Torah does not tell me exactly what Cain does, except for the fact that Cain brings the first korban, the first sacrifice. And in fact, what is a sacrifice? Why would one bring a sacrifice? It's very interesting. You know, there's certain experiences that we have that we know instinctively. So the Ramban, for example, says that the root of the word sacrifice in Hebrew, korban, is the word karov. You look at the beginning of the book of Leviticus. It's a vehicle to bring me close. Imagine, for example, that your wife has a birthday, your husband has a birthday, your boyfriend has a birthday, your girlfriend. So it's a given. What possessed Cain to bring a korban, to bring a sacrifice? The same thing that possesses me to make sure that on my wife's birthday, I have a present. Of course you have a present. It's your wife. You're married. Your children. You're not going to have a present for your child on their birthday? In fact, one year, we didn't manage to get one of our kids a birthday in time. So we realized they were too young. I think he was three. So he didn't have a birthday yet until we could get him a present. Because he didn't know what date it was, you know. And children could do that. In fact, last year we moved to Boca. My daughter, Adi, sharp. We get this note home, you know. We wish that we would have known that your daughter had a birthday. And she comes home with this birthday hat and whatever. Except that her birthday's in July, and this was like January. She comes into school. She tells her teacher, it's my birthday. So they made a big fuss out of her. Because it's a given that if it's your birthday, you get a present. And so if my wife has a birthday, I give her a present. Of course, I'm going to give her a present. No big chiddush. So if you really understand what that relationship is, it's not that you have this great idea to give a present. But what are you doing when you give a present? What is Cain doing in offering something up to God? Cain is recognizing that I am here because of Hashem. That I owe everything to Hashem. If I really understand what it is that God gives me, of course I have to give back to God. So the issue here is not in the action. There are three pieces, the Mesilat Yesharim, one of the most brilliant books ever written. It's written by Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the Ramchal, at 300 years ago. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar, of the ethical movement, had two books that he kept in his talus bag. This was one of them. He used to say, I can write hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of novel ideas, chidushim, on the Talmud. I don't believe I would be capable of writing one page of the Mesilas Yesharim. And in the Mesilas Yesharim, in Perek Yutet, in the 19th chapter, which deals with sort of the ways, Ofanei HaMaaseh, the essences of Chalkei HaChassidut, of what make a person righteous. He speaks about the fact that there are three parts to any given action. There is the action, the maaseh. There is the ofen hamaaseh, the way in which I do the action. And then there is the kavanah, the intent of the action. Again, there is the action, there is the fashion in which the action is done, and there is the intent behind the action. Most people understand that there are two pieces. Ramchal points out that there are three. Now, what is going on here? It's interesting. And the rabbis point this out. Cain, and this is again, this is a pshat-based comment from the context. When Cain brings his fruit, it says, Vayave Cain mipri adama. He brings from the vegetables. By Hevel, when Abel brings his sacrifice, it says, Vehevel hevi gamhu mipcharotzono michelvehen. He brings from the best of the flock. So there's something fundamentally different about the way in which Cain and Abel bring their sacrifice. Now understand, this is very deep. Very deep. And there are two opinions as to what is really going on when Cain brings his sacrifice. One says, Hevi min agarua, he brought from the worst fruit. Looked around, what, I'm going to waste good fruit? What's the point? God knows I love him. What, you're going to go out and you're going to buy a beautiful present? What, my wife doesn't know I love her? But I feel bad, I'll buy some flowers. The other is, no, Hevi min abaliado. He brought, says the Midrash, from whatever came to his hand. He brought the worst, or he brought whatever came to his hand. And one way of looking at this is that there really isn't a difference. Because by virtue of the fact that he brought whatever happened to come to his hand, he brought the worst. Because the issue here is not what he actually brought, but how he brought it. You know, what's the purpose of a korban? You see, Cain's problem was not in what he did, but in why he did it. What's the purpose of bringing a sacrifice? It's not because God needs a sacrifice, it's because we need a sacrifice, right? And what is it that we need about that sacrifice? That korban allows me to elevate my soul. It brings me close to God. And if when I'm bringing that sacrifice, I bring whatever comes, then what that really means, the Hebrew word is zilzul. I'm denigrating the act of bringing the korban itself. I'll give you an example. When I was a kid, so there were 2 days that you sort of thought about Dad. And that was it. Dad's birthday and Father's Day, right? And I used to get my dad and my brothers used to get, you know, the same things every year. There were 2 things we used to get him. One was a tie. And the other was allspice. Allspice. I don't know, there were like 3 colognes back then. Allspice, Brut by a Fabergé, right? And soap on a rope. Those were the 3 big things. My dad had a drawer full of allspice, Brut by Fabergé, soap on a rope. In fact, 1 year, I did an experiment just to see, you know? And I went into my dad's cupboard, and I went into the back of his cupboard, and I found one of the ties that I had given him a few years earlier. And I took it out, and I wrapped it up, put it in a nice box, and I gave it to him. And he loved it. And I started realizing I could do this every year and save myself a fortune. You know, I had an interesting discussion. I learned this from my wife. I had an interesting discussion. We just celebrated our daughter's bat mitzvah last year in June. And my wife and daughter put an enormous amount of energy into the invitation. And I could not fathom this. I said, I don't understand. How many invitations have you received? Do you save them? Do you cash them in the grocery store for bottles of Coca-Cola? So you feel guilty. You feel guilty. And I tell you this, by the way, now. If anybody here who's about to gets married, you don't have to send me an invitation. For 2 reasons. First of all, if I can come, I'm going to come anyway. I'm going to crash. So just save a seat. That's first of all. In fact, there's a story about Shlomo Kalbach that in the House of Love and Prayer. And he had, I forget her name, Nama, I think. Naman. And he had a couple students, and they were getting married, and they loved him. He was their Rebbe. So they came to him and they said, listen, you know, would you help us with the wording of the invitation? He was so excited. Of course, no problem. Give me, I'm going to write you the greatest, the holiest invitation. So they're so excited. It's going to be spiritual. It's going to be beautiful. People are going to open the invitation. It's going to save you forever. So he writes this invitation. They were a little surprised to discover that the language of the invitation. Because basically what he wrote was, the whole world is invited. The Rose and Naaman's wedding. And Bebet, you know, the whole world showed up. But of course, that's the beginning. It's not so much, and you know, finally, you know, I would kid around and say, what's the difference? What about if we just, you know, take pieces of paper and write, you know, dear Lisa, please come, Gamarnu. What if we call people up? It'll be so personal. Email, Rabbanu Shel Olam. No. and they put so much thought into it, and it was beautiful, and my wife got calls afterwards, and Mayan helped to draw it, and the dried flowers, and gewalt. And my wife finally said to me, you know, you don't understand. We're celebrating a mitzvah here. We're celebrating a simcha. 12 years we put into this girl. People should see how much we appreciate this moment. You don't send people a message, a simcha, a joyous, on a piece of toilet paper. And I had to realize she was right. So I forked out, right? You understand? You buy a present, you find a beautiful envelope. You know the person is going to rip open the envelope and throw it in the trash. And the ecologists completely correctly say, let's do away with envelopes. But there's something very powerful about the fact that when I send a message, I put it in a beautiful envelope because it says something about what's deep in the message. It says something about what's inside of me when I give that message. And what's amazing is that what we're really doing and what we do is tapping into what's inside of us. To what's inside of us. How we do something is very much wrapped up in why we do it and what it means to us. We just finished the festival of Sukkot. And more than any other festival almost, Zekeli Va'anvehu, I want to glorify God, to beautify God. So people have no obligation to do this. And it's very clear that you could buy the plainest etrog. People spend, it's unbelievable. Go to Mea Sharim, you walk in the court, people spend hours with magnifying glasses. I once had a student, I took him to the Four Species Market Fair, and there was a fellow examining the tip of a lulav, because there's a halacha with lulav, has to be straight, and you look at the center leaf, and if it's split, so then it's not as beautiful. Now technically, halachically, if it's split almost down the middle, but not half, it's a completely kosher lulav. But you won't find anyone who knows anything who uses such a lulav, who buys it ab initio to begin with. And we're at this market fair, and there's a fellow with a long beard looking very rabbinical, and he's got a magnifying glass. He's so frum, he's got the magnifying glass, and he's looking at the edge of the lulav. You know? And we had taken Israelite students, and one of them came over and he said, is there like a disease you have to look for when you look at lulavs? But the fact that we put that effort into those four species is about what it means to us. And that's the message. Rahmana libabai, says the Talmud in Sanhedrin. You know what Hashem wants from me? He doesn't want my animals. He doesn't want my lulav. He wants my heart. He wants my love. When I give my wife a present, when I give my children a present, the way in which I give that present is a message to them about how much I care about them. And how much I care about who they are to me. And so how I express my love to God is an expression of how much I value the part of God that's inside of me. And that's why this is such a crucial message. The Torah does allude to Cain's mistake. And Hashem makes a brilliant point that how you do and what's inside of you is what's really what matters. And that's the essence of this story. So there's a lot more to the story. And those of you still around at 10:10, you know, we can schmooze about it. You can look for more in the Parsha email. Thank you very much.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.